Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove that valleys, groves, hills, and fields, woods, or steppy mountain yield. And we will sit upon the rocks, seeing shepherds feed their flocks by shallow rivers to whose falls melodious birds sing madrigals. The second poem was written just a year later by Sir Walter Raleigh, The Nymph's Reply to the Shepherd. If all the world in love were young, and truth in every shepherd's tongue, then these pretty pleasures might me move to live with thee and be thy love. But time drives flocks from field to fold. When rivers rage and rocks grow cold, the flowers do fade, and wanton fields to wayward winter reckoning yields. Thy gown, thy shoes, thy beds of roses, thy cap, thy kirtle, and thy posies soon break, soon wither, soon forgotten, in folly ripe and reason rotten. If youth could last and love still breed, had joys no date nor age no need, then these delights my mind might move to live with thee and be thy love. It's not a rebuttal, but it really does bring more perspective into the issue. The shepherd and the nymph, echoing their enchantment across the ages, from the Song of Songs in the Hebrew Bible to the laments of country music. Gloria Steinem once was asked, "Why is it that women don't gamble as much as men?" And she replied, "Women's instinct for gambling is well satisfied by marriage." Romantic skeptics and curmudgeons have been at work for centuries, sifting through the debris. The English aristocrat Lady Astor once remarked to British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, "If you were my husband, Winston, I would put poison in your tea." And Churchill replied, "If I were your husband, Nancy, I would drink it." My remarks today apply whether you've been in a committed relationship for decades, or through a divorce, or are venturing into the swamp for the first time. I hope these remarks may be a lens through which to examine any relationship that matters to you. My question for today is, given our differences, including some that seem to threaten us, how might we deal with the messiness? Thankfully, some folks respond to love's foibles with a bit of humor. Consider these personal ads from an Israeli newspaper. "I am a sensitive Jewish prince whom you can open your heart to. Share your innermost thoughts and deepest secrets. Confide in me. I'll understand you. No fatties, please." Attractive Jewish woman, 35 plus, college grad, seeks successful Jewish prince charming to get me out of my parents' house. Jewish male, 34, very successful, independent, self-made, looking for a girl whose father will hire me. Female graduate student studying Kabbalah, Zohar, and exorcism of Dybbuk's, seeking a mensch. No weirdos, please. Divorced Jewish man seeks partner to attend shul with, light Shabbos candles, celebrate holidays, build sukkot together, attend brises and bar mitzvahs. Religion not important. Staunch Jewish feminist wears tzitzis, seeking male who will accept my independence, although you probably will not. Oh, just forget it. Such humor can be in short supply in matters of the heart. UU poet Rick Maston writes, "I have noticed that men somewhere around 40 tend to come in from the field with a sigh and, removing their coat in the hall, call out into the kitchen, 'You were right, Grace. It ain't out there. Just like you always said.' And she, with the children gone at last, puts her hat on her head. "The hell it ain't," she says. Coming and going, they pass in the doorway. A husband and wife visit a marriage counselor after 15 years or so of marriage, and the wife begins a rant, listing every problem they've had for the past 15 years. And finally, after a couple of hours, the counselor gets up, walks around his desk. He embraces the wife, kisses her passionately, and she is stunned into silence and sits kind of dazed. The counselor turns to the husband and says directly to him, "Now, this is what your wife needs at least 3 times a week. Can you do this?" And the husband thinks a moment and he says, "Well, I suppose I could drop her off on Mondays and Wednesdays, but on Friday I go fishing." We okay? Today I speak of love in any committed relationship, including marriage. Of all powers in the world, love is the most powerful and the most powerless. And you have the quote by Buechner in your order of service. It is the most powerful because it alone can conquer the human heart. It is powerless because it can do nothing but by consent. A couple of surmises about love. First of all, the love I'm speaking of is not primarily a feeling or emotion. It is the willed intent of the heart. Doesn't just happen. It's hard work. It requires discipline, opening your heart again and again to someone with whom right now you may be angry. If ours were an ideal world, each of us might have been generously loved by our parents and friends, who in turn were loved by their parents and friends. We would feel so much love by virtue of our heritage that we would be spontaneously open-hearted. But such is rarely the case. We've all experienced being loved too little, too late, or in self-serving, distorted ways. And thus, in seeking companionship with another, we limp along pathways full of potholes. The words, "love your neighbor," aren't about a warm, fuzzy emotion. Love your neighbor means that our own peace and happiness can never be complete unless we find ways of sharing it with those who may have very little happiness and peace. We are called not to warm, fuzzy sentimentality, but to bring light to dark places. Love is a radical intent of the heart. Doesn't just happen. Second, the love of which I speak will reshape the character of those whom it touches. You know, whenever I visit with couples who've invited me to prepare a marriage ceremony, I always schedule 2 or 3 conferences, and we consider ways in which the ceremony can be much more than just sentimental. And I suggest that in their decision to get married, they have chosen a person who will significantly reshape their character. They should anticipate that their partner will challenge some habits that they have grown accustomed to. And moreover, their partner will strengthen qualities that they may have taken for granted and may have forgotten. Now, this suggestion surprises some couples. The romantic ideal says that we are drawn to people who reinforce our virtues and vices. But it gets complicated. And it gets complicated because of this reshaping of character. Notice I say shaping, not chiseling, coercing, fixing. Shaping more in the sense of a magnet using its subtle influence to create a force feel that just may realign others within that force field. This is not manipulative. It doesn't happen by force, whether verbal or physical. It also doesn't happen through indifference. I do my thing, you do your thing. Where did that come from? Doesn't happen through indifference. Shaping happens through sustained subtle influence and by consent. Significantly reshape my character. I thought that marriage was about someone who would accept me as I am. Someone who will give me a strong comfort zone. What's this about reshaping my character? I have come to the conclusion, she said, that when we fall in love, we really fall in love with ourselves, that we choose particular people because they provide the particular mirrors in which we wish to look. And when did you discover this surprising bit of knowledge? He responded. After I had broken a few very fine mirrors, she said. In my counseling with couples, there's one thing I haven't yet done, and in the future I may just give it a try. What I may do is suggest, after we have your ceremony, I'd like to meet with you 6 months later for a little check-in. It'll last a couple of hours, no homework other than life itself, a free consultation. Let's agree to that right now. And then 6 months later, I'd give them each paper and pencil and ask them to consider 6 questions and to respond separately, and then we'd have some chit-chat. What would these questions be? Number one, how has being married changed the way in which you relate to each other? How has your partner encouraged and supported you when something is troubling you? How well do you and your partner discuss items of common concern and share your problem-solving processes with each other? How are you finding that your partner welcomes and encourages your wishes to take on something new? Are you satisfied with the way your partner expresses affection and responds to your feelings of sorrow and anger? And question 6, are you satisfied with the way you and your partner share your time together? These would be my 6 questions. The couple would do all the work, of course. I would say very little except to encourage their interaction. Who knows, I may give it a try. My colleague, Reverend John Corrado, writes, I saw 2 lovers the other day. He was in his 70s, she about the same. Not in Lover's Lane, but a hospital cafeteria. They caught my eye and I watched their lovemaking. He set his tray down, walked to where she had set hers down. Slowly and gently, he pulled out the chair she was about to sit in. She sat and then followed him with her eyes as he retrieved his tray and walked to a place across from her. As he set his tray down, she gently placed a steadying hand on his. There they were, truly lovers, talking softly as they ate. They weren't clutching or grabbing or cooing. Their looks and gestures weren't the kind seen in movie posters. Singles ads that speak of moonlit walks by a lake hardly touch what I was seeing. Their tenderness was much more seasoned and much more real. The moment spoke of years and a depth which were mere visceral passion. And more than visceral passion could know by itself. And I turned away, as any decent person should do, when in the presence of those making love. End of quote, John Corrado. Friends, enduring love cannot ultimately be based on infatuation. It demands humility and humor. Judith Viorst describes the difference between infatuation and enduring love. Infatuation is when you think that he's as sexy as Robert Redford, as smart as Henry Kissinger, as noble as Ralph Nader, as funny as Woody Allen, and as athletic as Jimmy Connors. But love is when you realize that he's as sexy as Woody Allen, as smart as Jimmy Connors, as funny as Ralph Nader, as athletic as Henry Kissinger, and he's nothing like Robert Redford in any way, and yet you're going to love him. In the play, A Raisin in the Sun, the father has died and the family is depending on $10,000 from his life insurance policy. The mother gives the money to the son to put in the bank, but he gives it away to a friend to invest in a liquor store, and the guy skips town with the money. After a heated argument with her mother, the daughter screams, "You saw what he did. Wasn't it you who taught me to despise any man who would do that?" The mother answers, "Yes, I taught you that. Me and your daddy did. But I taught you something else too. I taught you to love him." "Love him," the daughter screams. "There is nothing left to love." And then the mother speaks those memorable lines, "There is always something left to love. If you ain't learned that, you ain't learned nothing. Have you cried for that boy today?" I don't mean for yourself and for the family because we lost the money. I mean, have you cried for him? What he's been through and what it did to him. Child, when do you think is the time to love somebody the most? When they've done good and made things easy for everybody? Well, then you ain't been learning, because that ain't the time at all. It's when he's at his lowest and can't believe in himself because the world done whipped him so. When you start measuring somebody, measure him right. Measure him right. Make sure you've taken into account those hills and valleys he's come through. And so, to say that love is God is romantic idealism. But to say that God is love, that is either the last straw or maybe the ultimate.